What's going on, Warrior Soul Nation? This is Chris Albert, and welcome to another episode of the Warrior Soul Podcast. Today, we have the privilege of talking with Scott Using. Scott is a retired Marine Corps officer with over 24 years of experience in the United States Marine Corps, both as an enlisted man and as an officer. He went in 1988, got out 2013, and so much happened in the Marine Corps during that time. Scott's the author of a book called Echo in Ramadi, and it details his and his Marines' experience in the Second Battle of Ramadi, which was a very, very intense battle. And there's so many lessons to be learned here, not just about leadership in battle, but also leadership in life. Scott, in his civilian life, has made the effort to get out there, to help Gold Star families, to help other veterans, and to deliver an amazing message through his book. So if you're listening to this, get out a pen and paper and write down some of the gems he brings to you. Some of the things we're going to get into are leadership, of course, battlefield leadership, but also how to build a network, how to deliver value and to get people onto your side, how to carry yourself through the hard times and persist toward what you want to do in this life. It was an amazing conversation. Scott is an awesome individual, and his book is out in February. So we're going to put the pre-order link up on the show notes, but we're also going to have Scott on again as soon as his book comes out, because we want to get into the details of the lessons that this amazing book has to offer. Before we get into this conversation, I want to give you a little note from our sponsors, F-Bomb Nutrition, a great company run by great people. This company is awesome because they create amazing, portable, delicious packets of healthy fats. And they've got avocado oil, olive oil, coconut oil, MCT oil. And if you're doing a ketogenic or a paleo diet, it's really hard to get healthy fats on the go, but they have the solution here. But what I really love are their fuel packets, and they've got these amazing nut butters. They have this awesome chocolate macadamia nut butter with sea salt. That's awesome. One of my favorites is their coconut butter with macadamia nut butter and sea salt, and that's another really delicious thing that I eat every single day. If you're interested in checking them out, you can check them out at www.dropanfbomb.com. And Warrior Soul listeners get 20% off of their first order when they use the code Warrior Soul at checkout. So definitely go check them out. Also, I want to let you know we're always delivering amazing content over at www.warriorsoulagoji.com. We have some awesome articles up there, some great videos coming from the Warrior Soul Agoji YouTube channel on health, fitness, carrying yourself through this life and living your best life. So without further ado, let's get into this episode with Scott Using and his experience with Echo in Ramadi.
This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited, and you need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason: to live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast.
What is going on, everybody? This is Chris Albert, and welcome to the Warrior Soul Podcast. I want to wish everybody out there a happy holiday season. And today, I'm with Scott Using. Scott served for 24 years in the United States Marine Corps, both as an enlisted man and as an officer. And he's got a new book coming out about his time with Echo Company, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, in 2006 with the Battle of Ramadi. And he came on here to talk about that book. It's due out in February, and we're going to provide the links over there on Amazon. And we're going to be talking to him about his experience in both in his 24 years in the Marine Corps, which is astounding because I'd served 6 years. I couldn't imagine doing 24, and but people do. And going to be talking about his experience in the Battle of Ramadi, his experience over his many deployments, and his experience since then. What he's doing now in the civilian world, what his charity's doing, and where he wants to make an impact. So, Scott, I want to welcome you to the podcast.
Hey, thanks, Chris. It's great to be here.
Scott, I know 24 years is a long time. You got in the Marine Corps in 1989, I believe. Can you tell us a little bit about what made you decide to join the Marine Corps and what your experience was like as an enlisted man?
Yeah, so I got roped into joining the Marine Corps, like most of you, by some friends. And yeah, that was back in 1988. 89 is when I went to boot camp. But some friends of mine roped me in throughout my young adult life. I kind of steered wayward and got in my fair share of trouble. Did not have a very stellar career in school, cities. So when I was introduced to the Marine recruiters, you know, these guys were bigger than life in their blue dress uniforms, and they seemed like a pretty big group of risk takers. And I figured, well, this is a natural fit for me. So I enlisted. Shortly thereafter, Desert Storm kicked off. We did that, and then after my first enlistment, I very much realized the value of an education. So I went to college, fared much better in college at Illinois State, and graduated in 3 years with a very impeccable GPA, and then decided that I wanted to give back to the Marine Corps because my success in college was really attributed to the discipline I learned in the Marines. And once I went back, got my commission as an officer, I served in the infantry for the remainder of my time with multiple units. And some people ask, you know, like, well, why did you write a book about Echo and Ramadi? Was that the pinnacle of your career? And I'd have to say, yes. I mean, fighting with those men under those circumstances, probably the pinnacle of my career. But my transition from officer to enlisted had nothing to do with the fact other than I wanted to challenge myself at a different level, and I wanted to lead. That's where I always felt my place was, and I was very fortunate to be able to be given the privilege to lead some of the best young men and women that our nation has to offer. It's just absolute privilege.
Wow. I mean, as far as just the length of that career, you know, serving from 1988, 1989, all the way up through 2013, how did the Marine Corps change in that time? What was the difference from the late 80s all the way up through the 2000s?
Yeah, it vastly changed. It's really cool to look back on that from so many different aspects. I mean, we could talk about that just in one show. It's when you talk about the gear, the training, the mentality, the uniforms changed. But there's always one constant that is interesting. You know, there's a sine wave that goes from peacetime to wartime within the Marine Corps. And I saw all of that, the lulls in war from Iraq to the things occurring in the Horn of Africa to the Middle East, again, in Iraq and Afghanistan. So that throughout that, there's a constant that is always within the military service, and especially with the Marine Corps, and that is the discipline and the ethos that we share as Marines, which is really amazing. I mean, it just never stops. Whether I read books about World War II or Vietnam, or I talk to Vietnam veterans, war is timeless. It's not just a cliche. But also the training component is. And what's really great is that the Marine Corps especially, which I'm familiar with mostly, but service-wide, we've done such a phenomenal job adapting to the climate on the battlefield to provide these great venues to train our aviators, to train our infantry, to meet the needs on the battlefield. They're very adaptive. and our key leaders are so attuned to this. And we've got great guys sitting at the top level now that we're fortunate to have, like, you know, Secretary Mattis and Secretary Kelly, that really understand, they really have their thumb on the pulse of what our military needs. So that has changed. Although uniforms and gear and the technology has changed, our Marines, despite what you hear sometimes on mainstream media about the larger scale programmatics that are crumbling, the Marines and sailors and soldiers have some of the best high-tech gear on the battlefield. And it is really amazing, from the bulky, cumbersome gear that we used to have when I was a young enlisted guy in Desert Storm, to what these sleek aluminum rail fitted rifles and high speed optics that the young guys and women are carrying. It's just changed vastly. They've really adapted to the private sector mindset and getting that type of gear, I guess. So that was kind of, that's kind of a big change. But the training has always been a concept.
Yeah, it's always amazed me how much problem solving is such a skill that's required to be a Marine Corps infantryman. I mean, regardless of the gear you get, regardless of what you have at your disposal, if you're not able to apply the right tool in the right situation, and if you're not able to analyze the situation and have open eyes and keep your head on a swivel, then you know, you're not going to be applying everything correctly. I imagine as an officer, you got to see the bigger picture of that, you know, rising up from a platoon commander to company level and beyond.
Yeah. It's, you know, so we were talking about this before we started the show, but some people always ask me, it's like, well, does being enlisted, did that make you a better officer? My answer is always no. It didn't make me a better officer. There's absolutely plenty of fine officers that graduate from the Naval Academy or take traditional commissioning programs. Being enlisted gave me a different perspective on my use of whether we're preparing to go to war, whether we're in war. Training was always paramount, and I always made them train as if it was the last day. And I impose that at the lowest level, and especially for my young leaders, those young lieutenants and some of the captains and junior non-commissioned officers. You know, I always told them, there is no such thing as combat leadership, just leadership. I don't care if you're getting shot at or blown up or you've been injured or IED'd or whatever the case may be. Leaders lead in any kitchen, and that's the key thing. Because as you experience as well, there's no mission essential training list or training standard for train for long periods of boredom, Chris. I want you to sit around and train to do nothing. And then yeah, be ready to go at a moment's notice when the needle pegs in the red zone and go from 0 to 60. So that was a real challenge for me too. When you have this instrument of war of 250 independent souls on the battlefield in one of the most dynamic kinetic, which we fought in Iraq in 2006, is I could take a guy like you, or a young Marine or soldier, and give them a machine gun and say, I want you to attend, you've been trained on it, here's a box of ammunition, I want you to go from 0 to 60 and engage the enemy, kill with lethality. And they can do it. They can do it well, and I've seen them execute it. But real leadership challenge is when you transition into a different type of environment on the same battlefield, is to get that same Marine or soldier to go from 60 to 0. That's the real challenge. Because if you have to train your soldiers and Marines to be prepared for those moments that are punctuated by long periods of boredom, and then have them razor sharp when the friction starts. That's the real leadership challenge. And being able to identify that has always been where the science meets art, I suppose.
Yeah, and I can tell you as an enlisted Marine or former enlisted Marine, you know, the boredom is what's really hard. And that's where your mind starts getting after you. That's where you start, you know, kind of losing yourself a little bit. And I think that in a lot of ways, there's nothing more dangerous than a bunch of bored Marines, because it could go either way. You know, you're either, going to find something to make you less bored and get your ass in trouble, or you're gonna put your head down a little bit. So I can definitely see the leadership challenge there. Tell us about coming into that deployment. 2006, heading over to Ramadi with that group of Marines. Did you know what you were going to be facing over there? Did you know what the area was like? What did you know about Ramadi itself? Was it a surprise when you finally landed on the ground?
No, there were no surprises other than we were employed a little bit unconventionally or non-traditionally, so to speak. We absolutely were training for Iraq. We knew things were boiling over in 2006. When I took command, I graduated school early to fill the rifle companies because they needed commanders. So I drove across country from Virginia to Camp Pendleton, California, straight through, checked it, and on a Wednesday, took command on a Friday. And that next Tuesday, I was in 29 Palms in the high desert doing real-life training scenarios to prepare our guys for war. Out of that group of Marines, I was very fortunate to have about 50 to 60 NCOs and even some of the junior Lance Corporals who had fought just 18 months before in the first Battle of Ramadi in 2004, where sadly our battalion, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, amassed a casualty count that has been rivaled by very few in modern warfare. So we transitioned. We embarked the naval shipping out of San Diego, we sailed over, and once we got in the country, we were dispersed to support the surge strategy, this massive influx of troops on the battlefield. And our role was to go to these pockets of insurgent resistance. So Echo Company was deployed to 1BCT, the Ready First Brigade Combat Team, and I worked directly for 193, call sign Manchu. And then we kind of hopped around different units, myself and a fellow company commander, John Smith, who commanded Fox Company 2-4. We worked in that area and fought daily under some of the worst conditions. We knew what we were getting into. What we weren't expecting was the frequency and the intensity and the level of fighting that we encounter on a daily basis. And I can only say that because when I wrote my book, Echo and Ramadi, and I conducted over 75 interviews with my Marines and the families, my 04 Ramadi vets remarked that how vastly different it was. And even though they lost more guys in 2004, the intensity and the frequency in which we fought in 2006 was just unlike anything they ever imagined, because it wasn't a matter of if we were going to get shot at. It was when and how often. I mean, we literally set our watches by the number of times we were going to get engaged in sustained firefights on the battlefield of the body back then. So we were prepared. I can say that as a commander, you train your Marines to fight, and there's nothing more lethal than a Marine with a rifle on the battlefield. But you can never really prepare them for some of the horrific things they're going to see in the wake of destruction that follows in a city like Ramadi that was just devastated by years and years of combat. And you can never fully prepare yourself or these young Marines for losing their brothers. And one of the interesting things that I found as I wrote the book was that I was a captain with a lot of life experience. I mean, I was 36 years old. I was a little older than the average bear because I'd been enlisted. I went to college. I came back in as an officer. But through writing the book, Echo and Ramadi, what I noticed as I wrote, as I described all my Marines and the characters, was their ages. And the average age was around 20, 22 years old. But I didn't see Sergeant Albert. I didn't see that's all I saw. I didn't see the 22-year-old kid. All I saw was Sergeant Albert. I didn't see Lance Corporal Albert. Those young kids, that's all they were. And I was 36. So it took years of wisdom and probably a little experience to really understand when I was tasking these young guys to do these superhuman acts on the battlefield, it never really clicked with me until I wrote the book. And how amazed I sit today at how successful they were on the battlefield and the things that I challenged them to do. And they did it day in and day out with lethality, but also with honor, because they are trained that way. And that's, again, as a Marine, you understand this, that's in our ethos, is, you know, we are trained to kill the enemy, but we also do it the right way. And my guys never failed me in that regard. And I sit, you know, 11 years later, still equally as proud of all those guys for how they conducted themselves in that type of environment. Just really proud of all of them.
Yeah, we, you know, the Second Battle of Ramadi is something we hear about. It's in a lot of different venues now. I mean, we've seen it in movies as far as American Sniper. We hear about it a lot on you know, Jocko Willink's podcast, and we hear a lot about, you know, the intensity of the fighting and a bit about what the place looked like. But I can imagine that, you know, landing there and every time you're heading out on a mission, knowing that you're going to have contact with the enemy and knowing that there's probably going to be a roadside bomb there and that there's probably going to be some sort of attack that you're going to have to deal with. I imagine that that was definitely an intense situation. One of my questions here is this, you know, you're working with the Ready First Brigade and, you know, dealing with the United States Army. How was it working alongside the Army? How was it working alongside the other services there?
Love it. Have nothing but the utmost respect and admiration for all the service components that we worked over there. And Jocko, I believe it, and was with Team 5. We were kind of ships passing in the night. They were working in and around Central Ramadi with us. So their teams were over there. They did a rotation with 3 and 5, but the Task Force 1-9 Infantry was commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Ferry. And man, there's never been a group of soldiers that I've been more confident in their abilities. They were just true warfighters. And the way they employed us was phenomenal. We rolled in with so many Marines. Almost at one point, I had over 250 Marines in my company. And the average strength for the viewer or listener is normally around 180, 190 for Marine Infantry Company. But I was very passionate, taking on guys from Civil Affairs Group, interpreters, military working dogs, human exploitation guys, anybody who could carry a rifle, they were invited to come to the fight. I didn't want them sitting at the firm base. They wanted to get out in the action. And if they wanted to, I brought them along. And so our company strength grew. And when we checked in with the Army, we kind of looked like rock stars by our sheer numbers alone. Not by what we did, but the Army was only fielding about 80 to 90 soldiers per infantry company.
Wow.
Because of the length that they'd been in country, they spent 19 months there. Our time there seems like a drop in the bucket. 19 months is what these soldiers were doing over there. I'm just astounded by it. But they suffered so many losses through casualties and killed in action that their numbers really dwindled. So when we rolled in as part of the surge, it was like this massive, one of the commanders I work for called us his blunt instrument of war. And we just went through that town like a wrecking ball, and anything that peeked its head on around a corner was going to run smack dab into a fire team of heavily armed Marines and soldiers and just get crushed. And that was pretty much my strategy when we went in there. We were always aggressive. We were always engaging the enemy and hunting the enemy, and we never let them get the upper hand on us. We always wanted to keep knocking them back on our heels, and we were fortunate to do that with the support of the U.S. Army. They employed tanks. We had the largest Army tank task force in the history of modern warfare was in Ramadi in 06 with the Ready First, the 1st Armored Division. And when we transitioned to a separate part of town, we worked for Task Force 177 Armor, which was Steel Tigers. And when I checked in with the commander, he asked me, all right, we've got tanks, we've got tracks, we've got Bradleys, we've got Humvees. How many do you want, Scott? And I said, none. And he kind of looked at me and says, well, what do you mean? How are you going to get around? I said, we're light infantry. We're going to walk. I said, we're going to crawl through this part of the city. And down every alley, through every house and every building, and we're going to root out every insurgent scumbag that's living here, and we're going to clean this sector for you. He kind of smiled and, you know, again was impressed, and you know, I think our result proved worthy to him, and we were very successful what we did. And again, our methods were a little unconventional at times, but we had a plan, and some could call it controlled chaos, but it is a plan. And the Marines performed phenomenally, but we couldn't have done it without the Army. We couldn't have done it with the support from the guys we had back at the headquarters, working all the close air support and drone strikes for us, and rocket strikes that flew all the way 40 miles from Fallujah into our area that we were operating in. It was just a team effort, and those guys are amazing.
Awesome. Tell me about the hardest day you had there, because I want to get into a little bit more about, you know, the story there, but I don't want to go through the whole book. And I want people to be able to buy this when it comes out. Tell me about your hardest day in Ramadi.
That's hard to define. Any day that we lost a Marine was a hard day, obviously. And some, you know, it's difficult to imagine the type of loss that you suffer when you see your fellow Marines go down beside you. And it's nothing romantic about it as portrayed in Hollywood movies. It's a gripping, life-changing event that just consumes you at times. And no matter how much you train for that, those are absolutely the hardest days, Chris. And as strong as I wanted to remain for my Marines, you know, there were times that it was tough for me to do as a commander. But that's one of the things you just can't protect your Marines from. You can give them all the training and ammunition in the world, but to really fortify their soul and their spirit and their mindset when they have to experience that, those are the toughest days. Followed closely by those days when you have to pick up the phone and call the mother of a, you know, 19-year-old kid that you just lost, who ultimately your responsibility. That's a pretty tough day. So,
where did you draw your strength from during those times?
Oh, that's great. You know, there is the thing is, despite the loss, the heartache that comes with making those types of phone calls, when I did that, I was always astounded by the parents on the other end. One of my gold star moms, Jane Libby, you know, I vividly recall speaking to her, and these people can't be described as ordinary people that lose so much, but they can so much and love us so much despite their loss. And it's just amazing. And, you know, I'm listening to this woman who I've never met on the other end of the phone, and I can hear the compassion in her voice. And it is just something that is almost indescribable in words, to feel so cared for by a woman that you've never met, and to feel so loved by someone you've never met, when you're just telling her about the loss of her 20-year-old son. And it's just something that you draw strength from. And when you hear that voice, not talking to you as a Marine or as a commander, but as any mother with any son, that's when you feel that power, that strength and that spirit, because she knows how miserable it was for us all over there. And their entire family does. And every single phone call that I made like that reaffirmed that. And at the end of any phone call, they always wanted to tell us to, you know, keep fighting it, that they were with us. And it was just, I don't know where people come from like this. They're truly extraordinary people that raise these great warriors that are willing to fight and defend everything that we
do. I want to know also,
the most remarkable people, very fortunate to connect to today.
I think we cut out here for a second. Hold on 1 second, Scott. Okay, we're good now. Sorry, could you repeat what you just said? The bandwidth just cut out for a second.
Yeah, which part were we talking about?
You were talking about being on the phone with a mother who just lost her 19, 20-year-old son.
So to answer the question about where the strength comes from is, you know, when I had to make those phone calls to one of our Gold Star families and one in particular, Jenny Libby, it was astounding to me to hear the love and compassion in her voice that she was talking to me, not as a Marine or as a commander, but as any mother would to any son. And that was really something that I wasn't prepared for, because again, they continue to love us so much. And at the end of every phone call that I ever had to make like that, each of those family members always told us to keep fighting, to stay strong and to take care of each other, because they knew what a miserable place we were fighting in, and that our mental state and the fact that they were still supporting us despite their loss was what was going to bring more Marines home alive. And that's something that's another area where you can't train to regroup and get your guys recalibrated so they understand the loss, they understand the importance of the sacrifice that the brother just made, but they know that they have to keep fighting and they have to endure. And that's what Marines do. That's what they're really good at. And they find times on the battlefield to mourn. And then we always make sure that we have a ceremony when we get back to invite the families and memorialize them appropriately to complete the healing process. But part of the reason I wrote Echo and Ramadi was to honor the sacrifices and the spirit of my Marines and their families that gave so much while we fought, and that they still continue to give so much to this day. I'm still so inextricably connected to my Marines and especially my Gold Star families, which, and that network has grown even bigger. It's just amazing how big the network grows once you leave the military. I always thought when I was in the Marine Corps, it never got any bigger than that. Never a greater fraternity than being Marine Corps. But as a guy that spent 24 years in and now I'm out, I'm telling everybody, the organization and that network just continues to grow if you allow yourself to become a part of it. It's really amazing.
Wow. Tell me about some of the lessons you've learned while serving in Ramadi that you and maybe throughout your Marine Corps career that you still carry with you to this day. What are some of the most important lessons that you learned that you've been able to apply in the civilian world?
Well, I think the discipline that you learn throughout your career as a Marine, whether you spend 4 years or 24 years in the Marine Corps, Chris, that discipline is something that it's imbued in your fiber from day one. Some people let that slip. And I know Jocko Willink, his new book, the field manual he just put out on discipline, was really spot on. And he hits a nail on the head too, where I subscribe to the notion that there is no such thing as self-discipline. It's just discipline. You have to have that drive. You have to make things happen for yourself, and you have to create opportunities for yourself. And that's one of the things that's important when you talk about these young Marines who served in some of the worst conditions created by humanity, that they have to now leave the military and transition and find what makes them happy. I was lucky to do that. I worked in the private sector for a while, and then I was working so much, I realized I wanted to do something else. And that's the beauty of it, is in the military, you think, well, I'm going to do 4 years, or I'm going to do 20 years. And then you get out and you think, oh, I got to do this for 20 years. No, you don't. You can quit. You can do something totally different. You can bake pies. You can work on cars. You can write books. So there's a lot of great opportunities, but it doesn't happen itself. Cars don't fix themselves. You know, degrees don't appear on walls without hard work behind them. Books don't write themselves. Whatever it is that you're passionate about, I think that's based on the discipline that you'll learn throughout your military. And that's a strong lesson that I carried with me throughout my time. And I have to apply that on a daily basis, Chris, because despite the amount of experience I had in the Marine Corps and despite the life experiences I have, every day is a challenge. You know this as well, because I love your message too about staying strong spiritually, staying connected, staying physically fit. I mean, all of those components, that triad in and of itself is a secret to success that is demonstrated on a daily basis and taught to young Marines and military service members that you have to continue to apply. Because every morning I get up and my passion is writing, telling great stories about our nation's veterans and these living heroes, and there's thousands of them that should be writing and that need to be written, but also helping veterans, whether it's through my charity, through Save the Brave, or serving as the president of the 2-4 Association, or volunteering and helping my Gold Star families at events. That's what makes me happy. And if you can find that, you're a lucky person. And if you're suffering in a job and you don't like what you're doing, challenge yourself again to move on. And that's one of the things the Marine Corps teaches you, is to continually challenge yourself. But I tell people this too, through my experience, is that you need to understand that there's going to be slippery points along the road too. There's going to be areas where you lose traction and you fall. And Marines are the worst because they think they're impervious to the effects of gravity. Nothing can bring a Marine down, right? But I'm telling you, there's going to be points in life that you'll lose traction because life's slippery and you're going to fall. Some land harder than others, though, and that's what I always say. But through my experience and through my connections with other people and as I continue to grow, I think that it's allowed me, not only through my writing and sharing my story and those points of weakness and those moments where I've lost traction in life, I think it's helped me grow, to understand myself, become more humble, to realize your own humility in and of itself. And then also identify those slippery points that are laying on the road ahead of you. And if you can really identify those, you can formulate a plan for success so you don't fall and learn from mistakes. So that's a long answer to a kind of a short question, but mine is based off 24 years of experience. So I can give a lot of great advice. I always say advice is great. Take what you like and then push the rest to the side, because that's the beauty of advice. You don't have to take it all. And even from bad advice, sometimes people learn. So I've been very fortunate, though, to get a lot of great advice. And throughout my transition, Chris, in writing Echo and Ramadi, to demonstrate the power of the Marine Corps in and of itself and this network that I keep talking about. And it's not like a 5-CD self-help set. It's not the Church of Scientology. It's just a network of great people that want to help each other. In Bing West, James Livingston, Medal of Honor recipient, Oliver North, Jack Coffin, Dale Dye, Chris Libby, the list is endless of all these, you know, legends of the Marine Corps that have gotten behind this book and endorsed it and staked their reputations on it. That's the P I always say of the Marine Corps, is we don't play by the corporate business rules. You know, if the book wasn't written well, they would have probably gotten several phone calls and they said, Scott, hit the brakes on this. It's not right. I've been really fortunate to have the support of my Marine Corps family and everybody around me get behind the project and really allow me to tell another great story about a battle. And it's not, it's really about the people. You know, I like telling stories about people and the emotion and the feeling, not events and things, because that's what you pick up a newspaper for. So I've been really blessed to be able to tell their story. It was really my privilege and honor to do that.
No, I love it, Scott. And you know, very much like you said, life is a battle and you either gain or you lose momentum. And you know, I think a lot of the guys who get out, you have to understand that also a network isn't just going to present itself to you. You know, there's Marines out there, there's veterans out there who are willing to help you, but you have to do exactly what Scott did, which is search them out. And not only search them out, But you can't just go up to people and ask them for something. You've got to provide value as well. And if you're volunteering and putting effort in to help the network out, then you're going to get good things in return. And so it's really important for everybody out there listening to take this from Scott's experience. He's out there, he's helping other veterans. He's helping Gold Star families. He's writing about these experiences. He's putting the work in. And in order to bear fruit, you've got to plant seeds. And if you're not doing that, you're going to come up empty every single time. So if you're trying to figure out a way to move forward, get out there, start providing some value somewhere, start helping people out, start volunteering your time, and good things can come back to you.
Yeah, that's a great. I love planting seeds. I use it. You're lighting candles in my church right there. Yeah. One of my favorite. But yeah, it's really just putting some skin in the game. And when it comes to the charity through Save the Brave, a lot of people think it's about writing a big check. And hey, we love getting big checks. Don't get me wrong. But it's also about spending an hour or two of your weekend and volunteering your time and really putting some skin in the game to help these people out. And sometimes it's just listening to a veteran's story. It's something as simple as that. It's not just a bumper sticker on your car saying, "We support the troops." It takes a little bit more than that for me to know that you support the troops. And it does take going that extra step, driving an hour to an event, volunteering, standing in the sun for a hot afternoon in Southern California, whatever the case may be. We've seen example after example of people that are willing to do that. And that's, again, where you meet so many amazing people through this connection. And I just experienced this by being invited up to the Rob Riggle Invitational, the second annual for the Semper Fi Fund, and We Are the Mighty, which is another great organization that tells veteran stories. Shortly thereafter, I mean, just 2 days ago, they invited me to their Christmas party up in LA at the VFW in Hollywood. And again, you just meet so many people. In the Marine Corps, in the military, it's 2 degrees of separation. I guarantee you, the longer me and you talk, we know somebody that knows somebody. Mm-hmm. That's the power of the network. No one in their right mind enjoys driving into LA traffic, but that's what it took for me to make the event. And once I was there, it was phenomenal. That the veterans that I reunited with, the new people that I met with, the people that are willing to support veterans in this network, just a mind blower. And that you really have to be to do and just make the time. And that's what I call putting some skin in the game. And there's so many people out there doing it. I'm proud to call all of them my friends.
Awesome. Before we get out, we need to talk about the book a little bit more. And I want to know when you decided to write. You know, when did you decide that because I know writing is, I write blogs. I've never written a book. I've written ebooks, but I know that the process can be brutal. When did you decide that you were going to undertake this project? What led to it? How much time did you spend thinking about it? And how'd you get through it?
Well, it is a long process, and the Marines continually would email me and call and ask me, "Hey, sir, when's the book coming out?" And it's, you have to have a lot of patience because it is a long process, especially from the onset of writing the book and saying I need to tell this story, which started as early as 2009 when Major General Zomer sparked it in my head in the Philippines and said, "You guys made such a difference in Ramadi in 06. That's a story that needed to be told." So I started writing notes, and I was still on active duty. So now, you know, it just kind of trickled along. But it wasn't until I moved back from L.A. and got a ranch here in Southern California that I said, "I'm going to write this book." I spent hours and hours at writing, isolating my family. It was a difficult process. They didn't understand the creative side of it to a degree. But it's a challenge that I was willing to make because I was about the story. And the Second Battle of Ramadi and the stories of my Marines is just, they're singular in nature, but that story is really emblematic of what all the soldiers, all the Marines probably experience. And Echo and Ramadi, it was my way to help another portal for all those people to kind of heal through that. So you spend a year of your life writing. You lock yourself in a box or my office here, and you write a book. And you put your fingers on the keyboard, and you write. That's how books get written. And then you rewrite, and then you rewrite. And then you'll come to a point, you've written too much, and you find an editor. And the editor does great things. And sometimes it costs money out of your pocket to make it better. And then you, if you want to go the traditional publishing route, which I did, I was very fortunate, you have to find an agent. So then you get a lot of rejection and rejection and rejection. But you continue to put the work in, Chris, just like we were talking about. Continue to work, and you don't take it personally, because if you're sending your book to somebody that doesn't like war novels, it's the same as sending your record to somebody that punk rock music. They're a country artist, you know, agent. So expect rejection, and you just move on. But ultimately, I found a great agent. A month later, he sold the book to a major publishing house, Gregory Publishing, who has really embraced me as a first-time book author. I've written articles and stuff my entire career, but never do amazing things. They're always on deadline. The book comes out February 20th of 2018. So we're just in about 60 days. So the final tweak to the cover design, but it takes a lot of patience and a lot of new business sense. You know this as well. It's the literary world is it's a whole new business, and you have to be a self learner. You have to be a lifelong learner. And people, if they expect someone just to think that their book is going to be the next greatest thing, it's not. And I'm no Bing West or Chuck Sasser that's written, you know, 10, 12 books to give other veterans a lot of advice. But I do give advice that you need to put the work in and understand too that not everything's a book. You understand this too. Sometimes it's an expose. Sometimes it's a blog. Sometimes it's an ebook or just a short story or an article. And don't get discouraged with it, because I think everybody's story is important. And if you think your story is important, write about what you know and believe in it and tell the story well. Have your friends read it. Send it to guys like you. Have them proofread it. The Marines will never give you any false feedback. They'll tell you exactly how it is. Agents will tell you it's great. But Marines, they'll tell you exactly where you're at in the process. So I've been very fortunate to have that again from all my Marine brothers and sisters that I've shared it with.
Awesome. Well, February 20th coming out on Amazon and in bookstores everywhere, Echo and Ramadi. We're going to be putting a link up for the pre-order on the show notes for this episode. Scott, is there anything else you want to get out there to everybody listening before we jump off here? And by the way, I'm definitely going to ask you to come back on once the book is out, probably late February, early March, because I definitely want to check it out, get into the story here and have you back on to talk a little bit more about it.
I'd love to. I love what you're doing, Chris, and sharing great stories. And if people want to find out more about me, they can go to my website at www.echoandramadi. If they want to learn more about donating, they can go to www.savethebrave.org. And I'm just really excited to tell the story. They can follow me on Facebook or Twitter, and we will have a tour. I'm going to be going to the East Coast first for the launch, and then I'm making my way back to the West Coast. My plan is to stay connected with the people I love, and that's doing signings at military bases, veterans hospitals, the USS Yorktown, the Hornet up in the Bay Area, and setting up events. So they're very veteran friendly and really staying connected with the people that matter the most to me. But the book is really for everybody. It's not just another war story. It's about the people and the sacrifice and the emotion. And it's written in a way that it's not just military jargon. It's not just for the military reader. It's nonfiction, but it really reads like a novel. So if people want to find out the real unvarnished truth about what happens on the battlefield and the sacrifices of the Marines and the families that support us. Everybody should read this book. I think they'd be really enlightened to read their fascinating story. And I can't wait to come back on the show, Chris. It's going to be fun.
Absolutely, Scott. And I want to thank you for your service. I want to thank you for choosing to lead Marines out on the battlefield. And I want to thank you for putting the work in after your military service to help other Marines, help other veterans to achieve everything that they can and to help the Gold Star families who've suffered from so much loss. So thank you for that. And to everybody out there, I really want you to think about from this interview the amount of work that Scott has put in, not just the 24 years of service, but the fact that he didn't give up once he got out. It was just another start button, and he decided that he was going to live a life worth living after he got out. And you don't come to that easily. You know, there's a temptation there to really say, all right, I did what I could, I'm done, and I'm going to try and just cruise through life. But if you do that, you'll find that commitment you made to yourself a long time ago, where you told yourself you were going to make a difference, because if you decided to join the military in any branch of service, you decided you wanted to join because you wanted to be different. So take those lessons to heart, get out there, keep working, keep putting the effort in to keep yourself in shape, keep putting the effort in to find new passions and new people to help. And above all, just get out there and live your best lives. Till next time, guys, we will be back at you very soon with another great episode, and we will talk to you then.